stress, and uncertainty, or to use those resources to look at things through a lens of gratitude, hope, resilience, optimism, and meaning. In other words, while we, of course, can't change reality through sheer force of will alone, we can use our brains to change how we process the world. And that, in turn, changes how we react to it. Happiness is not about lying to ourselves or turning a blind eye to the negative, but about adjusting our brains so we can see the ways to rise above our circumstances. The Archimedean Formula. Archimedes, the greatest scientist and mathematician of ancient Greece, famously posited, "Give me a lever long enough and a fulcrum on which to place it, and I shall move the world." 2,200 years later, as I sat in a freshman dormitory watching students prepare for an exam, I had my own eureka moment. Our brains, too, operate according to the Archimedean formula. Take, for example, a seesaw. On a seesaw, the fulcrum is set at the exact center between the two seats. If two boys, each weighing 100 pounds, sit the same distance from the fulcrum on opposing seesaw seats, they will balance each other out until they start wiggling. Now imagine two boys, one weighing 100 pounds and the other 150 pounds, in the same situation. The smaller boy is going to hang in the air until the larger one either pushes off with his feet from the ground or, as boys sometimes do, jumps off and lets his smaller companion crash earthward. But what if we move the fulcrum? The closer we move the center point, the fulcrum, toward the heavier boy, the easier he is to lift. If we keep moving the fulcrum in that direction, eventually the lighter boy will effectively weigh more than his big-boned buddy. Move the fulcrum close enough to the heavier boy, and the lighter boy can climb off his seat, and with a single finger, use the seesaw lever to move his heavier friend up. In other words, by shifting this point around which energy is applied, we can effectively turn the seesaw from a balancing scale into a powerful lever. That was exactly Archimedes' point. If we have a long enough lever and a good place to stand, a fulcrum point, we can move the entire world. What I realized is that our brains work in precisely the same way. Our power to maximize our potential is based on two important things. Number one, the length of our lever, how much potential power and possibility we believe we have. And two, the position of our fulcrum, the mindset with which we generate the power to change. What this means in practical terms is that whether you are a student striving for better grades, a junior executive striving for better pay, or a teacher hoping to better inspire students, you don't need to try so hard to generate power and produce results. Our potential, as we saw in part one, is not fixed. The more we move our fulcrum, or mindset, the more our lever lengthens, and so the more power we generate. Move the fulcrum so that all the advantage goes to the negative mindset, and we never rise off the ground. Move the fulcrum to a positive mindset, and the lever's power is magnified, ready to move everything up. Simply put, by changing the fulcrum of our mindset and lengthening our lever of possibility, we change what is possible. It is not the weight of the world that determines what we can accomplish. It is our fulcrum and lever. Move the fulcrum, change reality. As a college senior, I took a class called The Einsteinian Revolution, taught by one of the most passionate professors I've ever known, Peter Galison. On the first day of the course, every humanities major in the class trembled in anticipation of the difficult workload. I remember whispering to one of my friends during the introduction to the first lecture, "If this took Einstein 20 years, how are we supposed to get it before the midterm?" But somehow, Galison took one of the most complicated subjects in physics and made it come to life. According to Einstein's special theory of relativity, many of the seemingly inviolable laws of the universe become altered based on the observer. As a result, some amazing impossibilities in a seemingly objective and fixed world suddenly become possible. For example, take two people one standing still, and the other traveling close to the speed of light. Common sense might tell you that both will age at the same rate. But in fact, the person remaining still ages faster because time dilates with motion relative from the stationary observer. In other words, time, once thought to be fixed and immutable, is actually relative to motion. According to Einstein, everything from length to distance to time is relative. If this sounds incredible, think about the impression it made on the nicely ordered world of classical physics. Relativity doesn't end with mere physics. Every second of our own experience has to be measured through a relative and subjective brain. In other words, reality is merely our brain's relative understanding of the world based on where and how we're observing it. Most important, we can change this perspective at any moment, and by doing so, change our experience of the world around us. This is what I mean by moving our fulcrum. Essentially, our mindset, and in turn our experience of the world, is never set in stone, but constantly in flux. If this is a startling realization for you, think of how shocking it was for a group of 75-year-old men who suddenly found themselves traveling back in time. Turning back the clock. If there is anything we thought we could be sure of, it's that time moves in only one direction. That was the prevailing view anyway, right up until my mentor, Ellen Langer, proved it wrong with one brilliant stroke. In 1979, Langer designed a week-long experiment on a group of 75-year-old men. The men knew little about the nature of the experiment except that they would be gone for a week at a retreat center, and they could bring along no pictures, newspapers, magazines, or books dated later than 1959. When they arrived, the men were gathered into a room and told that for the next week they were to pretend as though it was the year 1959, a time when these 75-year-old men were merely 55 years young. To reinforce the scenario, they were supposed to dress and act like they did at that time, and they were given ID badges with pictures of themselves in their mid-50s. Over the course of the week, they were instructed to talk about President Eisenhower and other events in their lives that had happened at that time. Some took to referring to their old jobs in the present tense as if they had never retired. Life and Saturday Evening Post issues from 1959 were displayed on the coffee tables. In short, everything was designed to make them see the world through the lens of being 55. Langer is a rogue psychologist. For nearly 40 years, she has challenged the expectations of the scientific community in ways no one saw coming. True to form, in this case, she had a truly radical hypothesis. She wanted to prove that our mental construction, the way we conceive of ourselves, has a direct influence upon the physical aging process. Langer had other words for it, but essentially she was arguing that by moving the fulcrum and lever of these 75-year-old men, she could change the objective reality of their age. And that is exactly what happened. Before the retreat, the men were tested on every aspect we assume deteriorates with age: physical strength, posture, perception, cognition, and short-term memory. After the retreat, most of the men had improved in every category. They were significantly more flexible, had better posture, and even much improved hand strength. Their average eyesight even improved by almost 10%, as did their performance on tests of memory. In over half the men, intelligence, long thought to be fixed from adolescence, moved up as well. Even their physical appearance changed. Random people who didn't know anything about the experiment were shown pictures of the men both before and after the experiment and asked to guess their age. Based on these objective ratings, the men looked, on average, 3 years younger than when they arrived. This flew in the face of everything we thought we understood about physiology and aging, and revealed radical new implications about the power of mindset to shape reality. As we'll discover in this chapter, our external reality is far more malleable than many of us think, and far more dependent on the eyes through which we view it. With the right mindset, our power to dictate this reality, and in turn the results of our actions, increases exponentially. Singing executives, placebos, and hotel maids. As I looked out at the 70 managing and executive directors who had assembled for my talk at UBS in Stamford, Connecticut, I found many of them staring back at me skeptically. Their company was suffering massive restructuring and layoffs, legal battles, and a share price 80% off its high. And there I stood, asking this room full of battle-weary bankers to sing "Row, row, row your boat" over and over again. At least this time I remembered to specify that they sing it in their own heads, not out loud, a detail I once forgot on Wall Street, where I quickly learned the true definition of tone deaf. My instructions were simple. Close your eyes and start singing the song in your head. When you get to the end, start again. Keep going until I say stop. They did as they were told, though occasionally the more cynical executives would peek to make sure I wasn't fooling with them, or clandestinely wiring up electric shocks. In fact, I was fastidiously watching the clock. Finally, I told everyone to stop, open their eyes, and write down how long they thought the experiment had lasted, in minutes and seconds. One man guessed that it had been 2 minutes, while another was sure it had been 4. A woman in the back of the room guessed 45 seconds. There were 70 people in the room, and I heard 70 different answers, ranging from 30 seconds to 5 minutes. All of the executives were convinced that their estimate was right, but of course, there can only be one correct answer, which in this case was exactly 70 seconds. I've done this experiment in nearly 40 countries, and every time I conduct it, I hear a tremendous range in answers. Shanghai wins for the largest split, from 20 seconds to 7 minutes. The point, of course, is that what feels like the blink of an eye to some can feel like an eternity to others. Depending on their mindset, each person experiences the objective reality of time differently. Perhaps those who think the song or the exercise or both is stupid and boring and are impatient to get back to work tend to make longer guesses, while those who are interested and engaged in the talk or simply enjoy the brief period of relaxation tend to guess the time as being shorter. As we all know, time flies when you're having fun. The reason I enjoy this exercise is because psychology has shown that mindset doesn't just change how we feel about an experience. It actually changes the objective results of that experience. Anyone who has heard about the placebo effect already knows how powerfully this works. Countless studies show that when patients are given a sugar pill and told it will help alleviate some symptom, it often does so, sometimes as effectively as the actual drug. In a New York Times article entitled "Placebos Prove So Powerful Even Experts Are Surprised," doctors described studies where fake hair product grew hair on balding heads and sham surgery diminished swelling and hurt knees. Indeed, an empirical review of placebo studies found that placebos are about 55% to 60% as effective as most active medications like aspirin and codeine for controlling pain. The simple change in mindset, that is, a belief that they are taking an actual drug, is powerful enough to make the objective symptom actually disappear. Then there's what might be thought of as the reverse placebo effect, which is, in many ways, even more fascinating. In one of my favorite all-time experiments, Japanese researchers blindfolded a group of students and told them their right arms were being rubbed with a poison ivy plant. Afterward, all 13 of the students' arms reacted with the classic symptoms of poison ivy: itching, boils, and redness. Not surprising. Until you find out that the plant used for the study wasn't poison ivy at all, just a harmless shrub. The students' beliefs were actually strong enough to create the biological effects of poison ivy, even though no such plant had touched them. Then on the student's other arm, the researchers rubbed an actual poison ivy, but told them it was a harmless plant. Even though all 13 students were highly allergic, only 2 of them broke out into the poison ivy rash. I love this experiment. But the most staggering part is the fact that the researchers somehow got permission to spread poison ivy on people who are highly allergic. I had to wait months for departmental permission to ask Harvard students to play charades. So how exactly is it that our relative perception of what is happening, or what we think will happen, can actually affect what does happen? One answer is that the brain is organized to act on what we predict will happen next, something psychologists call expectancy theory. Dr. Marcel Kinsborn, a neuroscientist at the New School for Social Research in New York, explains that our expectations create brain patterns that can be just as real as those created by events in the real world. In other words, the expectation of an event causes the same complex set of neurons to fire as though the event were actually taking place, triggering a cascade of events in the nervous system that leads to a whole host of real physical consequences. What this means in the workplace is that beliefs can actually change the concrete results of our efforts and our work. This isn't just a theory. It's been proven by a number of serious scientific studies. In one conducted a few years ago, Ali Crum, one of my former students and now a research colleague from Yale University, teamed up with Ellen Langer to perform an experiment on the cleaning staff of 7 different hotels. They told half of the employees how much exercise they were getting every day through their work, how many calories their daily activities burned, how similar vacuuming is to a cardio workout, and so on. The other half of the cleaning staff, as the control group, was given no such good news. At the end of the experiment, several weeks later, Crum and Langer found that those who had been primed to think of their work as exercise had actually lost weight. Not only that, but their cholesterol had also dropped. These individuals had not done any more work, nor had they exercised any more than the control group. The only difference was in how their brains conceived of the work they were doing. That point is so important, it bears repeating. The mental construction of our daily activities, more than the activity itself, defines our reality. More than 24 hours in a day. Given what we now know about the relative nature of time, ask yourself this. How much more efficient and productive, not to mention happy, could you be if you changed the way you view the hours in your workday? In a scenario where reality could be experienced in any number of ways depending on where you put your fulcrum, the question becomes not, why are there only 24 hours in a day? But how can I use my relative experience of the workday to my best advantage? The most successful people adopt a mindset that not only makes their workdays more bearable, but also helps them work longer, harder, and faster than their negative mindset peers. In essence, these people use their positive mindsets to gain control, relatively speaking, of time itself. For them, 24/7 is only an objective clock calendar measurement. They take the same units of time given to everyone and use their mindset to become more efficient and productive. Think of the last interminable meeting you were forced to sit through. You probably won't have to think back that far. You may have decided in the first 3 minutes that the stated objective of the meeting was not going to be met, or that you didn't care about the objective to begin with. Those 2 hours that followed suddenly became a tremendous waste of time, a drain on your energy and productivity, and probably also your motivation. But what if instead you chose to see the meeting as an opportunity and created your own objective? What if you forced yourself to learn 3 new things before the meeting ended? If you can't learn them from the actual content of the meeting, and let's be honest, many meetings offer quite a low ratio of useful content to minutes spent sitting, be more creative. What can you learn from the speaker about how to, or not to, give a good presentation? How would you present this idea differently? What's the best way to handle difficult questions from colleagues? What's the best background color for PowerPoint slides? Now think about other daily tasks you find just as tedious as meetings. I think you'll find that the more you think of them as drudgery, the more they become just that. I watched my own brain nearly succumb to this trap when I was researching this chapter. I generally love reading psychology books at coffee shops and then talking about their ideas with colleagues and students. My brain considers that fun and playtime. but because I had a deadline for finishing this book, I needed to read those studies for research. Suddenly, my mindset changed. Reading psychology books was now work, and my brain attempted to avoid what I normally love. Tasks I once completed quickly and joyfully now made me feel as though I were wading through mental molasses. I realized it was time to move the fulcrum. I thought about how I was defining the task mentally, menial labor, and consciously changed it to reading for enrichment. I also changed the language I used to describe the activity to other people. After telling a few friends I was at Starbucks reading for pleasure, I started to realize, in fact, I was. Altering my conception of the time constraints also proved helpful. Tal Ben-Shahar has pointed out that the term deadline is about as negative as you can get. How true. He likes to use the term lifeline instead. For me, the renewed enthusiasm for my work came when I ignored the constraint entirely and thought only of the intrinsic value I derived from the activity itself, instead of simply when it was due. It also helped to stop focusing on how I would use the material I was reading later on. When we reconnect ourselves with the pleasure of the means, as opposed to only focusing on the ends, we adopt a mindset more conducive not only to enjoyment, but to better results. I'm pleased to report that I did, in fact, turn in my manuscript on time, in case you're wondering. Just as our view of work affects our real experience of it, so too does our view of leisure. If our mindset conceives of free time, hobby time, or family time as non-productive, then we will, in fact, make it a waste of time. For example, many of the business leaders and Harvard students I work with exhibit the telltale signs of the workaholic's curse. They conceive of all the time spent away from actual work to be a hindrance to their productivity, so they squander it. As one CEO of a telecommunications company in Malaysia told me, "I wanted to be productive because that's what makes me happy. So I tried to maximize the time I spent working. But as I later realized, I had too narrowly defined what being productive was. I started to feel guilty when I did anything that wasn't work. Nothing else, not exercise or time with my wife or relaxation, was productive. So I never had time to recharge my batteries, which meant that, ironically, the more I worked, the more my productivity plummeted." As we learned in the last chapter, allowing ourselves to engage in activities we enjoy can actually greatly enhance our performance at work. But simply doing them is not enough to get results. Just like it was not enough for the hotel maids who only went through the motions and did not think at all about the exercise they were getting. When your brain conceives of family dinner, or Sudoku, or fantasy football, or a phone call with a friend as a waste of time, it won't be able to reap its inherent benefits. But if you change the fulcrum so you conceive of such free time as a chance to learn and practice new things, to recharge your batteries and connect with others, you'll be able to leverage the power of that rest time and return stronger than before. The lever of possibility. Just as your mindset about work affects your performance, so too does your mindset about your own ability. What I mean is that the more you believe in your own ability to succeed, the more likely it is that you will. This may seem like overly inspirational hokum to some, and in truth, the idea has been peddled by some less than reputable sources over the years. But the last few decades have seen an explosion of serious science in support of it. Studies show that simply believing we can bring about positive change in our lives increases motivation and job performance, that success, in essence, becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. One study of 112 entry-level accountants found that those who believed that they could accomplish what they set out to do were the ones who 10 months later scored the best job performance ratings from their supervisors. Amazingly, their belief in their own ability was an even stronger predictor of job performance than the actual level of skill or training they had. More important, our beliefs about our abilities are not necessarily innate, but can change as our mindset is almost always in flux. In a study performed by Margaret Shi and her colleagues at Harvard, a group of Asian women were given similar math tests on two separate occasions. The first time around, they were primed to think about the fact that they were women, stereotypically worse at math than men. The second time around, they were told to focus on their identity as Asians, generally thought to be math whizzes compared to other ethnic groups. The result? The women performed far better in the second situation than they did in the first. Their math IQs hadn't changed, and neither had the difficulty of the questions. But in the second instance, they believed more in their ability, and this was enough to make a substantive difference in performance. A fascinating real-life example of this emerged shortly after the 2008 presidential election. Decades of research had shown that internalizing racial stereotypes contributes to the achievement gap between Black and white students. For instance, African-American students perform worse than whites on standardized tests when they're asked to fill out a form beforehand disclosing their race. A team of researchers wondered if the ascendance of an African-American to the country's highest office could lessen this phenomenon. So they administered a 20-question standardized test to more than 400 Americans before the election and again right afterward. On the first test, Blacks did indeed score worse than whites overall. But on the second, their scores improved so dramatically that the performance gap was erased entirely. As the New York Times reported, the inspiring role model that Mr. Obama projected erased the self-doubt that had hindered Black performance. While this was only one study, and its effects were probably temporary, it illustrates how strongly our beliefs can affect our abilities. At the leadership training firm Ideology, the trainers often ask their clients one question. What identity are you wearing today? If you're sporting self-doubt, you've undercut your performance before you even begin. So when faced with a difficult task or challenge, give yourself an immediate competitive advantage by focusing on all the reasons you will succeed, rather than fail. Remind yourself of the relevant skills you have, rather than those you lack. Think of a time you have been in a similar circumstance in the past and performed well. Years of research have shown that a specific and concerted focus on your strengths during a difficult task produces the best results. You can use this technique in any situation. In charge of making Thanksgiving dinner but worry the food might not turn out as well as you'd like? Focus on the fact that you're good at time management and at following directions. Have to give a big presentation but believe you're a weak public speaker? Focus on how prepared you are or how much research you've done on the material. This doesn't mean you should ignore your weaknesses or chant empty affirmations to yourself or take on tasks you can't handle. It just means to focus on what you're actually good at as you walk down the hallway. Remember your signature strengths from the last chapter? Pick one that applies to the challenge at hand. When I have to give a lecture on new material, and I'm unsure how it will be received, I try to focus on the fact that I'm pretty good at reading people and how that helps me connect to an audience. There's a palpable difference in the quality of my talks when I remember to take this approach, as opposed to when I fall into the trap of lamenting my poor memorization skills or propensity to pace incessantly. Leveraging intelligence. More important still than believing in your own abilities is believing you can improve these abilities. Few people have proved this theory more convincingly than Stanford psychologist Carol Dweck, whose studies show that whether or not someone believes their intelligence is changeable directly affects their achievement. Dweck found that people can be split into two categories. Those with a fixed mindset believe that their capabilities are already set, while those with a growth mindset believe that they can enhance their basic qualities through effort. A growth mindset is not dismissive of innate ability. It merely recognizes, as Dweck explains, that although people may differ in every which way, in their initial talents and aptitudes, interests, or temperaments, everyone can change and grow through application and experience. Her research has shown that people with fixed mindsets miss choice opportunities for improvement and consistently underperform, while those with a growth mindset watch their abilities move ever upward. In one study, Dweck and her colleagues tested 373 students at the start of seventh grade to find out whether they had a fixed or a growth mindset. The researchers then tracked their academic achievement over the next 2 years. They found that a student's mindset began to have an increasingly large effect on the math achievement scores as he or she progressed through 7th and 8th grade. The grade point average of students with a fixed theory of intelligence remained flat, while students with a growth mindset experienced an upward trajectory in their GPA. Simply, those who believed they could improve did. The researchers suggested a number of reasons a growth mindset propels students to further success, but it basically comes down to motivation. When we believe there will be a positive payoff for our effort, we work harder instead of succumbing to helplessness. Beliefs are so powerful because they dictate our efforts and actions. In another of her studies, this one in Hong Kong, Dweck showed how growth mindsets lead people to maximize their potential, while fixed mindsets hold us back. At the University of Hong Kong, classes, textbooks, and exams are all in English, so you have to speak the language well to be successful. But many students are not fluent in English when they start classes. So as Dweck says, it would make sense for them to do something about it in a hurry. To these students, her team of researchers posed the question, if the faculty offered a course for students who need to improve their English skills, would you take it? Then they also assessed each student's mindset. Did they think their intelligence was fixed and couldn't be changed, or did they think they could improve their intelligence? It turns out that the students with a growth mindset were the ones who gave an emphatic yes to the opportunity to take the English course, while those with a fixed mindset chose on the whole to skip it. Those who simply believed in their own power to change followed a course of action that maximized their college performance. The others, given the same opportunity, squandered it. Once we realize how much our reality depends on how we view it, it comes as less of a surprise that our external circumstances predict only about 10% of our total happiness. This is why Sonja Lubomirsky, a leader in the scientific study of well-being, has written that she prefers the phrase creation or construction of happiness to the more popular pursuit, since research shows that it's in our power to fashion it for ourselves. As all these mindset studies have shown, this is true for positive outcomes and success in any other domain. By changing the way we perceive ourselves and our work, we can dramatically improve our results. Using the fulcrum and lever to find your calling. Yale psychologist Amy Rozinski has made a living out of studying how the mental conceptions we have of our jobs affect performance. After many years and hundreds of interviews with workers in every conceivable profession, she's found that employees have one of three work orientations, or mindsets, about our work. We view our work as a job, a career, or a calling. People with a job see work as a chore, and their paycheck as the reward. They work because they have to, and constantly look forward to the time they can spend away from their job. By contrast, people who view their work as a career work not only out of necessity, but also to advance and succeed. They are invested in their work and want to do well. Finally, people with a calling view work as an end in itself. Their work is fulfilling, not because of external rewards, but because they feel it contributes to the greater good, draws on their personal strengths, and gives them meaning and purpose. Unsurprisingly, people with a calling orientation not only find their work more rewarding, but work harder and longer because of it. And as a result, these are the people who are generally more likely to get ahead. For those who already see their work as a calling, this is great news. Those who don't, though, needn't despair. Rozinski's most interesting finding is not just that people see their work in one of these three ways, but that it fundamentally doesn't matter what type of job one has. She found that there are doctors who see their work only as a job, and janitors who see their work as a calling. In fact, in one study of 24 administrative assistants, each orientation was represented in nearly equal thirds, even though their objective situations, job descriptions, salary, and level of education were nearly identical. What this means is that a calling orientation can have just as much to do with mindset as it does with the actual work being done. In other words, unhappy employees can find ways to improve their work life that don't involve quitting, changing jobs or careers, or going off to find themselves. Organizational psychologists call this job crafting, but in essence, it involves simply adjusting one's mindset. As Rosinski says, new possibilities open for the meaning of work simply by the way it is constructed by the individual. How does this work? Well, if you can't make actual changes to your daily work, ask yourself what potential meaning and pleasure already exist in what you do. Imagine two janitors at the local elementary school. One focuses only on the mess he must clean up each night, while the other believes that he is contributing to a cleaner and healthier environment for the students. They both undertake the same tasks every day, but their different mindsets dictate their work satisfaction, their sense of fulfillment, and ultimately, how well they do their job. In my consulting work with companies, I encourage employees to rewrite their job description into a calling description. I have them think about how the same tasks might be written in a way that would entice others to apply for the job. The goal is not to misrepresent the work they do, but to highlight the meaning that can be derived from it. Then I ask them to think of their own personal goals in life. How can their current job tasks be connected to this larger purpose? Researchers have found that even the smallest tasks can be imbued with greater meaning when they are connected to personal goals and values. The more we can align our daily tasks with our personal vision, the more likely we are to see work as a calling. Try this exercise. Turn a piece of paper horizontally, and on the left-hand side, write down a task you're forced to perform at work that feels devoid of meaning. Then ask yourself, what is the purpose of this task? What will it accomplish? Draw an arrow to the right and write this answer down. If what you wrote still seems unimportant, ask yourself again, what does this result lead to? Draw another arrow and write this down. Keep going until you get to a result that is meaningful to you. In this way, you can connect every small thing you do to the larger picture, to a goal that keeps you motivated and energized. If you're a law professor and you hate administrative work, draw your arrow until you can connect it to something you do care about, like providing a new generation of young lawyers with the resources they need to succeed. Chip Conley, the innovative hotelier I mentioned in the last chapter, uses a similar strategy to engage his employees. He likes to tell each one, forget about your current job title. What would our customers call your job title if they described it by the impact you have on their lives? When you make these larger connections, your mundane tasks not only become more palatable, but you perform them with far greater dedication and see greater returns in performance as a result. We aren't saving dolphins. Before speaking at one Fortune 500 company in New York this past summer, I was introduced by a senior-level executive who explained to the audience of 80 salespeople why I was invited. Having not heard my talk yet, he riffed on the importance of the training. Look, I understand that you are all here at work to make money, and you are frustrated that pay has been lowered over the past 2 quarters. So don't think about this as a session about happiness. Think about how these strategies will help you make more money. To be honest, it has to be about money. We're not saving the dolphins here. A few people laughed wryly, but I wasn't one of them. This executive had unwittingly primed his employees for failure. Here's what he had effectively said. Saving the dolphins is meaningful and has a positive effect upon the world, while the job you're in provides no meaning and worth beyond making you a lot of money. He had reminded everyone that they had jobs, not callings. Sure enough, his dolphin quip had an immediate impact upon the room. It was a poignant and humbling moment to see the group's mood deflate. Many of the employees, who had moments ago seemed excited about discussing happiness at work, suddenly gave off subtle but palpable signs of disappointment, chagrin, frustration, embarrassment, or disinterest. The fastest way to disengage an employee is to tell him his work is meaningful only because of the paycheck. This is not to say that all jobs have equal meaning, but that even a rote or routine task can be meaningful if you find a good reason to be invested. You feel productive at the end of the day. You showed people you were smart or efficient. You made life easier for a client or customer. You improved your skill set. You learned from a mistake. I've met high school students bagging groceries at HEB near my house in Waco, who sacked as if it was a calling. Of course, they didn't want to do that job their entire lives. But while they were doing their work, they were making the most of it. And I've worked with entrepreneurs who have built $100 million companies who view their job as soul draining. You can have the best job in the world, but if you can't find the meaning in it, you won't enjoy it, whether you are a movie maker or an NFL playmaker. Changing the fulcrum and lever of those around you. As we have seen, a few choice words can alter a person's mindset, which in turn can alter their accomplishments. All it took for the hotel maids to lose weight was a short talk about how physically active they were. All it took for the Asian women to excel on a math test was a researcher reminding them of their innate intelligence. These studies show how mindset can affect performance, but also how we can affect the mindset of others. Sometimes a few key words here and there can make all the difference. Imagine then the power we all have to influence the performance of those around us, positively or negatively. For instance, when researchers remind elderly people that cognition typically declines with age, they perform worse on memory tests than those who had no such reminder. How many well-meaning managers shoot themselves in the foot when they similarly remind those under them at work of their weaknesses? Conversely, as we have seen, when a manager openly expresses his faith in an employee's skill, he doesn't just improve mood and motivation, he actually improves their likelihood of succeeding. Even the way we describe seemingly straightforward tasks can make a difference in how people perform. In one experiment, subjects were asked to play either the Wall Street game or the community game, a task designed to measure people's willingness to cooperate under different conditions. In reality, they were the exact same game. But those who had been primed to think of the community were more likely to be cooperative than those thinking of Wall Street. What we expect from people and from ourselves manifests itself in the words we use, and those words can have a powerful effect on end results. This means, as you will continue to see in the upcoming chapters, that the best managers and leaders view each interaction as an opportunity to prime their employees for excellence. The Pygmalion Effect. According to the Roman poet Ovid, the sculptor Pygmalion could look at a piece of marble and see the sculpture trapped inside of it. In particular, Pygmalion had a vision of his ideal, the zenith of all of his hopes and desires, a woman he named Galatea. One day, he began to chisel the marble, crafting it to his vision. When he was finished, he stepped back and looked at his work. It was beautiful. Galatea was more than just a woman. The statue represented every hope, every dream, every possibility, every meaning, beauty itself. Inevitably, Pygmalion fell in love. Now, Pygmalion was no fool. He was not in love with a stone woman. He was in love with the possibility of his ideal coming to life. So he asked the goddess of love, Venus, if she would grant him one wish and make his ideal a reality. And so she did, at least according to the myth. Now fast forward to the 20th century, to one of the most well-known psychology experiments ever performed. A team of researchers led by Robert Rosenthal went into an elementary school and administered intelligence tests to the students. The researchers then told the teachers in each of the classrooms which students, say, Sam, Sally, and Sarah, the data had identified as academic superstars, the ones with the greatest potential for growth. They asked the teachers not to mention the results of the study to the students and not to spend any more or less time with them. And in fact, the teachers were warned that they would be observed to make sure that they did not. At the end of the year, the students were tested again, and indeed, Sam, Sally, and Sarah posted off-the-chart intellectual ability. This would be a predictable story, except for an O. Henry-type twist at the end. When Sam, Sally, and Sarah had been tested at the beginning of the experiment, they were found to be absolutely, wonderfully ordinary. The researchers had randomly picked their names and then lied to the teachers about their ability. But after the experiment, they had in fact turned into academic superstars. So what caused these ordinary students to become extraordinary? Although the teachers had said nothing directly to these students and had spent equal amounts of time with everyone, two crucial things had happened. The belief the teachers had in the students' potential had been unwittingly and non-verbally communicated. More important, these non-verbal messages were then digested by the students and transformed into reality. This phenomenon is called the Pygmalion effect, when our belief in another person's potential brings that potential to life. Whether we are trying to uncover the talent in a class of second graders, or in the workers sitting around at the morning meeting, the Pygmalion effect can happen anywhere. The expectations we have about our children, coworkers, and spouses, whether or not they are ever voiced, can make that expectation a reality. Motivating a team with the Pygmalion effect. In the 1960s, MIT business professor Douglas McGregor famously posited that managers subscribe to one of two theories of human motivation. Theory X holds that people work because you pay them, and that if you don't watch them, they will stop working. Theory Y holds the opposite, that people work for intrinsic motives, that they work harder and better when not being ordered around, and that they do it for the satisfaction they receive from good work. When researchers tried to study what happens when X or Y workers are exposed to leaders with the opposing view, they run into a very telling snag. Very few managers have employees with opposing theories. Managers who believe theory X turn out to have workers who need constant supervision, while managers who hold to theory Y have employees who work for the love of the job. Turns out that no matter what their motivations might have been before working for these managers, employees typically become the kind of worker their manager expects them to be. Here is the Pygmalion effect in action. This is a shining example of a self-fulfilling prophecy. People act as we expect them to act, which means that a leader's expectations about what he thinks will motivate his employees often end up coming true. The more that Fortune 500 executive assumed his employees worked for their paychecks and not to save the dolphins, the more their motivation shifted toward Theory X, further and further away from meaningful work. In fact, rarely have I seen an optimistic and motivated worker under the supervision of a pessimistic, apathetic manager. As the leaders go, so go their employees. Naturally, the Pygmalion effect can be a very powerful tool in business. So if you are a leader, whether of 3 people or 300, remember that the power to affect results rests not just in who is on your team, but how you leverage your team. Every Monday, ask yourself these 3 questions. 1. Do I believe that the intelligence and skills of my employees are not fixed, but can be improved with effort? 2. Do I believe that my employees want to make that effort, just as they want to find meaning and fulfillment in their jobs? And 3, how am I conveying these beliefs in my daily words and actions? Superman's cape. In some states, the Superman capes you can buy for Halloween are required to carry a warning that the capes won't actually help you fly. Sounds hilarious, but it's a useful reminder of the one caveat to the fulcrum and lever principle. While it's important to shift our fulcrum to a more positive mindset, we don't want to shift it too far. In other words, we have to be careful not to have unrealistic expectations about our potential. While so much of our experience is relative and dependent on mindset, there are, of course, still concrete restraints, like gravity for one. but it returns us to the question I posed in the chapter, Change is Possible. How do we know what our potential is, and what kind of limits should we put on it? Imagine, for example, running shoes that say, do not attempt to run a sub-4-minute mile. Injuries could result. Such warnings might sometimes be necessary, of course. It's when they cause us to artificially shorten our horizons that they cause a problem. My field of study attempts to push back at these illusory boundaries by looking at positive outliers who have already gone beyond them. We want to push the limits of possibility as far as they can go, not limit them in the way too many discouraging bosses, parents, teachers, or media stories tell us they should be limited. Sure, simply believing we can fly won't set us aloft. Yet if we don't believe, we have no chance of ever making it off the ground. And as science has shown, when we believe we can do more and achieve more, or when others believe it for us, that is often the precise reason we do achieve more. The heart of the challenge is to stop thinking of the world as fixed, when reality is, in truth, relative. We have seen how 75-year-old men turn back their biological clocks, how a few choice words and beliefs can improve test scores, and how some employees find callings where others see only jobs. Yet this is still a relatively small glimpse into all the ways our mindset can shape the objective world around us. The next few chapters will show us precisely how we can cultivate a positive mindset and capitalize on this positivity to move ever upward in our jobs, our careers, and our organizations. Principle number 3, the Tetris effect. Training your brain to capitalize on possibility. One chilly Massachusetts morning back in September of 2005, I walked out of Wigglesworth Residence Hall. Yes, that's the real name. And almost attempted to steal a police car. Admittedly, this had all the earmarks of a bad career move, especially since part of my job description was to be a positive role model and help teach impressionable young undergraduates a sense of responsibility. So what could possibly have driven me to do such a thing? Unbelievably, it was a video game called Grand Theft Auto, which I had stayed up until 4 a.m. playing the night before. For 5 straight hours, my brain had grown accustomed to the following pattern. Find a car to steal, engage in a high-speed chase, reap the reward, in this case, fake money. Of course, this was just a stupid video game and should have had absolutely no bearing upon my behavior in the real world. But after so many hours of repeated play, when I woke up the next morning, my brain was still stuck in this way of thinking, which is why I walked out onto Massachusetts Avenue and scanned my environment for a vulnerable car. To my brain's momentary delight, the best car to steal, a police car, was serendipitously parked not 5 feet from me. Yes, before the rational part of my brain had time to get a word in edgewise, I found myself acting on the pattern I had been practicing the night before. Adrenaline shot through my body as I reached for the shiny handle of the Cambridge police cruiser. The fact that there is a police officer sitting in the front seat, well, that was no problem. I would just have to press X on the controller and would automatically pull the officer from the car. It took seeing my reflection in the window to finally jolt me out of the Grand Theft Auto world and back into my senses. True story. Blessedly, I did not go through with the crime. Can you imagine the trial? Harvard advisor tells court, brain stuck in Vice City, couldn't help it. Yet while obviously I had no real desire to commit grand larceny that morning, for that one moment, I could only follow the pattern I had been practicing to see. And as I soon learned, this is not entirely uncommon. It has to do with the way our brains are programmed to work in the real world. Getting in shapes. In September 2002, a British 23-year-old named Faiz Chopdat was jailed for 4 months after refusing to turn off his cell phone on a flight from Egypt to England. The crew had repeatedly requested that he switch off the phone so it wouldn't interfere with the plane's communication system, and he'd openly ignored them. The reason? He was playing Tetris. Tetris, as you probably know, is a deceptively simple game in which four kinds of shapes fall from the top of the screen, and the player can rotate or move them until they hit the bottom. When these blocks create an unbroken horizontal line across the entire screen, that line disappears. The sole point of the game is to arrange the falling shapes in a way that will create as many unbroken lines as possible. Sounds boring, but as Chopdat learned the hard way, it could be surprisingly addictive. In a study at Harvard Medical School's Department of Psychiatry, researchers paid 27 people to play Tetris for multiple hours a day, 3 days in a row. Whenever I mention this to students, they can't believe they missed the opportunity to play video games for pay. But wait until you hear the side effects, I tell them. For days after the study, some participants literally couldn't stop dreaming about shapes falling from the sky. Others couldn't stop seeing these shapes everywhere, even in their waking hours. Quite simply, they couldn't stop seeing their world as being made up of sequences of Tetris blocks. One Tetris addict wrote about his own experience in the Philadelphia City paper. Walking through the aisles at the local Acme, trying to decide between Honey Nut or the new Frosted Cheerios, I noticed how perfectly one set of cereal boxes would fit in with the gap on the row below it. Running doggedly around the track at the Y, bored out of my mind, I find myself focusing on the brick wall and calculating which direction I'd have to rotate those slightly darker bricks to make them fit in with the uneven row of dark bricks a few feet lower on the wall. Going out to get some fresh air after hours of work, I rub my watery, stinging eyes, look up at the Philadelphia skyline and wonder, if I flip the Victory Building on its side, would it fit into the gap between Liberties 1 and 2? Gamers soon took to calling this bizarre condition the Tetris effect. What was going on here? Are Tetris addicts temporarily insane? Not at all. The Tetris effect stems from a very normal physical process that repeated playing triggers in their brains. They become stuck in something called a cognitive afterimage. You know those blue or green dots that cloud your vision for a few seconds after someone takes a flash photograph of you? This happens because the flash has momentarily burned an image onto your visual field, so that as you look around at the world, you see that same light pattern, that afterimage, everywhere. When these kids played Tetris for an extended period, they similarly became stuck with something clouding their vision. In this case, a cognitive pattern that caused them to involuntarily see Tetris shapes wherever they looked. Just as Grand Theft Auto had made me involuntarily see cars to lift. This isn't just a vision problem. Playing hour after hour of Tetris actually changes the wiring of the brain. Specifically, as subsequent studies found, the consistent play was creating new neural pathways, new connections that warped the way they viewed real-life situations. To be sure, this would be great news if these students were training for a Tetris tournament, but it proved extremely maladaptive when they were doing non-Tetris activities. And let's face it, very few jobs reward obsessive Tetris playing. That's the way it is with our brains. They very easily get stuck in patterns of viewing the world, some more beneficial than others. But of course, the Tetris effect isn't just about video games. As we're about to explain in more detail, it is a metaphor for the way our brains dictate the way we see the world around us. The Tetris effect at work. Everyone knows someone stuck in some version of the Tetris effect. Someone who is unable to break a pattern of thinking or behaving. Often this pattern can be negative. The friend who walks into any room and immediately finds the one thing to complain about. The boss who focuses on what an employee continues to do wrong instead of how he's improving. The colleague who predicts doom before every meeting, no matter the circumstances. You know the type. Maybe you're even one of them. In my work with Fortune 500 companies, I've learned something very valuable. These people usually aren't trying to be difficult or grumpy. Their brains are just really outstanding at scanning their environment for negatives, at immediately spotting the annoyances and stresses and hassles. And no small wonder, given that, like Tetris players, their brains have been honed and trained to do so through years of practice. Unfortunately, our society only encourages this kind of trading. Think about it. In the work world, as in our personal lives, we are often rewarded for noticing the problems that need solving, the stresses that need managing, and the injustices